Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom. Greetings on this 25th day of the 11th month on the sacred calendar from a temperate Central Florida. Some of you are freezing in New York City, but I'm sure you're enjoying being up there in the very core of the Big Apple. So greetings to you up there. I spent a lot of time there, as you know. We are a lot of this audience watching me at this moment are in the United States, a nation of great power and influence in the world. And many of you are listening also from other countries, and that's great. So greetings to all of you out there, wherever you may be listening now, or perhaps delayed, you know, later on, whenever you get around to it. But in America, I want to take note of the fact that we have two great presidents, great figures in our history that we honor in an interesting way because just coincidentally, they were born in the same month on the secular calendar. So the third Monday in February in America is President's Day. And on that day, we honor the first president of this country, George Washington. Some of you are listening in British Columbia, and you have near you Washington, the state of Washington, which came into the Union 100 years after the inauguration of the first president, Washington. And you know that if you know something about America's currency, those of you who are in other countries, Washington is on the 25-cent piece, the quarter, and Washington is on the dollar bill. And our capital is named for him, Washington, District of Columbia, Washington, D.C. And you may, again, if you know American currency, Abraham Lincoln is on the penny and on the $5 bill, and also the capital of Nebraska is named after Lincoln, the state of Nebraska in the middle of our country. So Washington and Lincoln were born in the month of February, the first president and the 16th president. Washington, famous as the general who won our independence and who was the father of his country, presided at the Constitutional Convention, became the first president of the United States, father of his country, first in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen. That's what is said about him here in this country. First in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen. And then a second great president, well known around the world, Abraham Lincoln, the 16th president of the United States, who was assassinated, became a martyr in that sense, who saved the Union and freed the slaves. So we have President's Day to honor those men. So that's putting on my historian's cap for a moment. Now I want to put on my archaeologist cap. You know, I had in my youth had the opportunity to work in the field of archaeology. I was on the excavations in the southwest corner of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. It's now a park that people can visit, an archaeological park that people can visit. Sometimes I tell my students, I teach immigrants the English language. I teach English as a second language. Sometimes I tell my students that as a young person, I was involved in archaeological excavations. So I tell them, have you heard of Indiana Jones? Now you have Indiana Mark. But I tell them that I never found anything particularly significant, so I never became famous like Indiana Jones. So I wound up teaching English as a second language. I didn't wind up with it as a career as an archaeologist. But I'll tell you a story about some archaeologists that were excavating around the Sinai area, Sinai Peninsula. And they found a tablet, and as they were translating the tablet, it said, how to serve man. And then they began to study it further. At first, they thought it was an ethical treatise, how to serve man. But then they studied it further, and then they realized it was how to serve manna. And one of the archaeologists shouted out, it's a cookbook! Now, that's an inside joke for those of you who were fans of the old series Twilight Zone. But I do want to talk about manna today, and I want to talk about other lessons from the Pentateuch. Some of you are reading through the Pentateuch this year, this sabbatical year, and I want to talk about some lessons from the book of Deuteronomy that are very powerful and that Jesus Christ made use of at a very great climactic moment in salvation history. So I call this talk today Lessons 1, 2, 3. Victory with Deuteronomy. Lessons 1, 2, 3. Victory with Deuteronomy. Our first human beings, as we understand the term, Adam and Eve, rebelled in a very serious way against God. It was a very major act of rebellion, and it set the course for civilization, what we call civilization. And in doing so, there were three principles that became a part of this world civilization that make for worldliness. So I want to go to Genesis, the third chapter, and the sixth verse. And unfortunately, Eve began the sin. So when the woman, this is Genesis 3, 6. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes. I have an announcement. Good, I'll read it later. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree, okay, let's go back. It was good for food. She saw that it looked good. You know, wow, it had an attractive appearance. It seemed to promise that it would be quite delicious. So it had that attractiveness. So she saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes. Oh, pleasant to the eyes. A desirable thing, my margin says. And the tree desirable to make one wise. So, first of all, she had this desire to eat to satisfy her craving, the lust of the flesh. And then she had the lust of the eyes, you know, that it was pleasant to the eyes. It looked good for food. You know, you get hungry, you want to eat. You don't want to put it off and delay it. You don't want to restrict what you put into your mouth. Human beings are like little babies, right? A baby puts anything into his mouth. Over time, you develop certain tendencies of what you do or don't want to eat, you know, but God regulates that in the Bible. So she saw that it was good for food, satisfying the lust of the flesh. She saw that it was pleasant to the eyes, satisfying the lust of the eyes. And a tree desirable to make one wise. Oh, you know what the devil told her, you know. Well, I'll go back to verse 5, you know. For God knows that in the day that you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So the pride of life, right? The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. So this is what causes us to sin. This is worldliness. This is what causes us to be hostile to God's law. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. I want to go to 1 John 2 and verse 15. The writings of John are tied in with the book of Genesis because he wrote at the end of the Bible. So the end of the Bible ties us back into the beginning, Genesis and the writings of John. What scholars call the Johannine writings are tied together. 1 John 2 and verse 15, he tells us, do not love the world or the things in the world. Now we understand, it doesn't refer to the people. The same John, I believe it's the same John, at least it's the Johannine writings to you scholars out there. In John 3, we're told God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. So it's not a matter of not loving people. It's a matter of the society and civilization contrary to God's way of life. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Why? Because this world is geared to what I talked about. So much of this world and its civilization points us in the direction of the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. I'm going to read about it in John verse 3:16. And it's so sad. If you really think about the culture that you grew up in, wherever you live, that was often what was appealed to, those factors. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And then he tells us, and the world is passing away. Yes, this is a material world. It's not here forever. And the world is passing away and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. These three weaknesses of human nature are what the devil works on. My son gave a sermon on this subject, and it related to this subject at the Festival of Tabernacles. And I'm going to, I guess I started to talk, so it's too late now to back down. I'm hoping what I can do is encourage him to put it together in a sermonette form and give it during the Days of Unleavened Bread as a sermonette that you can hear. So we'll see how he does on that. Maybe he can do it as a PowerPoint presentation. Nowadays, I watch these history lectures on C-SPAN, and nearly all of them now are, you know, have audio-visual with them, PowerPoint presentations. Very few scholars get up there without, you know, some kind of projections backing them up. It seems to be the way of it now. I'd like to begin by going to Exodus 16. Exodus 16, and here we see the problem of the lust of the flesh. Exodus 16. I will go to verse 6. I'll go a little earlier than that, verse 4. Then the Eternal said to Moses, this is Exodus 16:4, Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. Wow. He's going to sustain them supernaturally through this wilderness journey. And the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my way, in my law or not. So this was a test. This was a way of training them to gather a certain amount each day. There's lessons to be learned there, and I'll say something about that as I go along. And it shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily. Then Moses and Aaron said to all the children of Israel, At evening you shall know that the Eternal has brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Eternal, for he hears your complaints against the Eternal. For what are we that you complain against us? And Moses said, This shall be seen when the Eternal gives you meat to eat in the evening. So he did satisfy that immediate need, and then he's going to feed them now supernaturally with manna. And in the morning, bread to the full for the Eternal. And of course, this is his personal name, Yahweh, but I'm translating it because when they heard the name, it had a meaning. It wasn't just syllables, Yahweh, had a meaning. For the Eternal hears your complaints which you make against him. And what are we? Your complaints are not against us, but against the Eternal. Let's jump down to verse 12. I have heard the complaints of the children of Israel. Speak to them, saying, At twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. And you shall know that I am the Eternal your God. So it was that quails came up at evening and covered the camp. And in the morning the dew lay all around the camp. And when the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a small round substance as fine as frost on the ground. Now scholars speculate as to what this was, and there are some secular explanations as to what it might have been, but, you know, in a sense what it resembled. But this was supernatural. This was God's intervention for those people. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, What is it, right? And so it's called what? It's called what, you know? Man, it's called man. They were saying, you know, what is it? Mahu or mazeh. Let me go to Exodus 16 in the Hebrew. This week, the synagogues are reading the portion that comes after the Ten Commandments about the various judgments that were given right after the Decalogue is given. I'm going back a little farther than that to Exodus 13. And I'm going to Exodus 16, right? And I'm going to verse 13, verse 15, right? So the children of Israel saw it, and they asked, Manhu, what is it? Manhu, what is it? So they called it man, meaning what? You know, what is it? Nowadays in Hebrew we would say mazeh, you know, what is it? So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, What is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, This is the bread which the Eternal has given you to eat. This is the thing which the Eternal has commanded, let every man gather according to each one's need. One omer for each person, according to the number of persons, let every man take for those who are in his tent. Then the children of Israel did so and gathered some more, some less. So they, you know, they did a certain amount of work. They gathered a certain amount. And it's interesting. It all worked out. God intervened in that way. So when they measured it by omers, he who gathered much had nothing left over. And he who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need. So you couldn't sort of outguess God. You couldn't sort of take more than was appropriate, because as you'll see, you couldn't keep it over. And Moses said, "Let no one leave any of it till morning." And yet you know human nature. Notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses, but some of them left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. So they gathered it every morning, every man according to his need, and when the sun became hot, it melted. Now this is an important lesson, because we have to be spiritually fed every day. We need to pray and study on a daily basis. And so it was on the sixth day that they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one. And all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. So you see, before the Decalogue was given, God was reminding them which day is the Sabbath. Friday, they got a double portion. In Jewish homes today, all around the world, on Friday night, there are two challot there, two loaves of challah, for the double portion that fell on Friday. Then he said to them, "This is what the Eternal has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Eternal. Bake what you will bake today and boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning." So they laid it up till morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. So you see, after decades of this, they get the point about preparing for the Sabbath and keeping it. So that's two things we have to remember. Prepare ahead of time for the Sabbath and keep it. Then Moses said, "Eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Eternal. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be none." And as you could imagine, it's really rough to read this, because these are my ancestors and they're really a pain. Now it happened that some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found none. Well, they were told not to go out. It's Sabbath. Rest. You got a double portion the day before. And the Eternal said to Moses, "How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for the Eternal has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day. Now, of course, the Pharisees, you know, they got carried away with this. And they developed the concept that no man should go out of his place on the Sabbath. What is your place? You know, so they define the Sabbath day's journey. If you leave town, if you leave the borders of your city and go out into the woods, into the countryside, can't go more than a kilometer out into the countryside. You know, if let's say you want to take a stroll out into the woods, and so you know, hopefully you've got your wife or your girlfriend with you. Anyway, you go out and you take a nice stroll, and but you can only go a kilometer because that's a Sabbath day's journey. That's not what it's talking about here. It's talking about going out and gathering manna. Anyway, so the people rested on the seventh day, and the house of Israel called its name manna. And now I think we have a slide here, and it was like white coriander seed, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. So one way it looked was like coriander seed, and evidently it was white in those days in that region, but evidently the seed is normally yellowish nowadays, the coriander we have now. Then Moses said, "This is the thing which the Eternal has commanded. Fill an omer with it, to be kept for your generations, that you may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt." So manna was saved in the area of the Ark of the Covenant. The book of Hebrews talks about it. And Moses said to Aaron, "Take a pot and put an omer of manna in it and lay it up before the Eternal to be kept for your generations." And the Eternal commanded Moses, as Yahweh commanded Moses, so Aaron laid it up before the testimony to be kept. And the children of Israel ate manna 40 years until they came to an inhabited land. They ate manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. Now in Numbers 11, now it said, by the way, I don't know if I talked about the taste of it. Let me go back to the taste. in verse 31. And it was, I'm going to the second part of the verse, and it was like white coriander seed, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. So it had a pleasant taste, a sweet taste, according to that account. Now, it may be that it had a variety of flavors, you know, depending, maybe the first portion of it tasted one way, and then as you got into it, it may be sweetened, so you have kind of a dessert. It starts maybe one way and ends up another way. Could be. If you go to Numbers 11, it's described differently. And here they're complaining about it. Now, I would imagine that manna was really good. I mean, God gave this manna to them. But, you know, after a while, after decades, you begin to think, you get bored with it. There's got to be something better. And frankly, a lot of you who are listening to me, you've been with this a long time, this way of life. But it should be perpetually new and refreshing to you. You know, quite frankly, the world we live in now is deviating so far from it that, you know, being a Christian nowadays, there was a famous movie, you know, back in the 1950s, there were a lot of Bible movies. In one of the movies, there's this pagan woman, and she says to the Christian, why would you want to live such a dull life forever? And he says to her, being a Christian nowadays is anything but dull. You know, he's about to be thrown into the arena, you know. And that's true. Nowadays, being a Christian is anything but dull, I can tell you. You know, the world that we live in now is just going so far. And that's why I would really recommend you read the Pentateuch. Because if you read it and you think about the value system there versus the value system around us now, wherever we live, we have deviated far from the standard. But anyway, so I'm going to Numbers 11. So they're bored with the manna. Verse 5. We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. Well, all right, maybe they fed you so that you could work for them. You were slaves. Remember? But now our whole being is dried up. There's nothing at all except this manna before our eyes. Now it describes the manna here. Now the manna was like coriander seed and its color like the color of bdellium. So if you look at the slide, maybe we'll have a slide of a cluster of bdellium, this mineral. And evidently this has a yellowish color to it. The people went about it and gathered it, grounded it on millstones, or beat it on the mortar, cooked it in pans, and made cakes of it. And its taste was like the taste of pastry prepared with oil. So here, perhaps, maybe as I said, when you first began to eat it, it wasn't so sweet until you got into it more, and then it maybe got sweeter as you ate it, and as I said, became kind of desserty at the end, whatever. I'm speculating now. And verse 9, and when the dew fell on the camp in the night, the manna fell on it. So the people were trained to have this manna. Now, if you keep reading, you'll find that they lusted, they wanted meat, and they made you know, pigs of themselves, to use an English idiom, and were punished for it. And this all goes into the concept of the lust of the flesh. I want to go to Deuteronomy 8, and God speaks about this, or Moses does. God speaks about it through Moses. I'll go to verse 3. This is Deuteronomy 8:3. So he humbled you, allowed you to hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Eternal. And this will be relevant to the Q&A later. Obviously, he's talking about human beings in general, not just man, but human beings in general. Many times we say man, meaning human beings in general. Now, in modern times, since the 1970s in America and perhaps in other countries, we're so sensitive to gender discrimination that now we tend to, you know, be more careful how we say things. And so instead of talking about man, we talk about, you know, men and women, or people, or humans, or, you know, we tend to be more careful because we don't want to offend. But generally speaking, over centuries, when we said man, and we often meant, you know, man in general. So that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Eternal. So that was the lesson of the manna. Remember that when you are tempted, when you lust for whatever it is, physical, remember that this world, as I read to you from John, this is not, you know, ultimately where the action is. You know, there was the civil rights movement had a saying, eyes on the prize. You know, I think Juan Williams wrote a book Ron Williams, who's an expert on the civil rights movement. He's a commentator on TV. He wrote a book called, I think, Eyes on the Prize. Well, anyway, your eyes should be on the prize. Don't get wrapped up in the physical, but think beyond that. Think beyond that. So when you're tempted to, immerse yourself, get wrapped up in the physical, think beyond it. Think spiritually. We don't live by bread alone, but we live by every word of God. All right, I'd like to go now back to Exodus 17, another embarrassing episode in Israelite history. Then all the congregation, this is Exodus 17, of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Eternal, and came to Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. Well, they were in the desert. Therefore, the people contended with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." Now, remember, God had given 10 plagues to the Egyptians. For most of them, the Israelites were miraculously spared. And then came the Red Sea episode, all of that. And these are the same people. They experienced all of that. They saw the Red Sea split. They walked through it to the other side. They saw the waters come upon the Egyptians and drown them all. They saw all that. Therefore, the people contended with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." So Moses said to them, "Why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Eternal?" So they, you know, some people like to do that. They get a kick out of that. Like, if I'm wrong, let God strike me dead or something. Like, God's supposed to be all worried about you. Ooh, there's one person down there that's criticizing me. You know, he's supposed to, but that's the way some people are. You know, they blaspheme, and because they, you know, they're not immediately dealt with. You know, there's a Psalm 50 talks about that, you know. That because you're not dealt with immediately, and of course Ecclesiastes talks about it as well. When sentence is not carried out immediately, people get emboldened to do wrong. Well, God is very patient, and God is letting people, in effect, you know, giving them enough rope to hang themselves if that's what they're going to do. Now, there are times, though, that he does step in, you know. At times he does give us a lesson. For example, Ananias and Sapphira, they lied to Peter, and they were both killed. You know, so there are times God does step in and do it. But anyway, we don't tempt the Lord. We don't tempt Yahweh, the Eternal. For example, you don't take unnecessary risks because you think that somehow God's going to protect you. He's not under some obligation to step in if you're being foolhardy, right? If let's say you're texting while you're driving down the road. That's irresponsible behavior. It's against the law in this state, by the way, where I'm speaking now, Florida. It's against the law to text while you're driving, you know. While you're driving. Anyway, verse 3, "And the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, 'Why is it you have brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children, our livestock with thirst?'" Isn't that horrible to think would say a thing like that? "So Moses cried out to Yahweh and saying, 'What shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me.'" Could you imagine? "And the Eternal said to Moses, 'Go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take also in your hand your rod with which you struck the river, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink.' And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel." There's a beautiful Hebrew song about this, you know. Moshe hikatsur. I won't sing any more of it. Anyway, verse 7. "So he called the name of the place Massa," testing, right? They tested, they contended with the Eternal. Merivah, contention, strife. You know, my margin says tempted and contention. Massa and Merivah, because of the contention of the children of Israel, because they tempted the Eternal, saying, "Is the Eternal among us or not?" So God intervened, and water came out of the rock. But I think that the next verse is partly because of their attitude. They were so vile that now this problem comes upon them. That's in verse 8. "Now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim." Now God intervened and saved them from and gave them the victory. But I wonder if this attack by the Amalekites was not to some degree a punishment for their attitude. So we have to learn not to tempt God, not to go out of our way to do foolhardy things, you know, to see just how far close to the line we can get before we cross it. You know how what I'm saying. A lot of people always want to know, well, just how much can I get away with? You know, how much can I do? You know, where do you draw the line? Well, how about, you know, getting this side of the line and not, you know, not going to the edge? I'd now like to go to Deuteronomy, the sixth chapter. The sixth chapter. And and Moses says this. He tells them in verse 16, you shall not tempt. This is Deuteronomy 6:16. You shall not tempt or test. This is Deuteronomy 6, verse 16. You shall not tempt the Eternal your God as you tempted him in Massah. No, right? But rather be obedient, have a right attitude. You shall diligently keep the commandments of the Eternal your God, his testimonies, and his statutes, which he has commanded you. And then it goes on, you know. In fact, if you look at Deuteronomy, it talks about really focusing on God, having God as the center of our lives, our chief concern. Pleasing God is our chief concern. If our chief concern is pleasing God, then we're going to, of course, extend love to our fellow human beings created in his image. And then we go to verse 13, and I'll go back to verse 12. Then beware, lest you forget the Eternal your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. You shall fear the Eternal your God and serve him, and shall take oaths in his name. Okay, so remember, number one, there's the lust of the flesh, but the lust of the flesh is counteracted by the fact that we keep in mind also the spiritual. We also have the pride of life, you know, that we also have the lust of the eyes. We want things, you know, we want all of these things. But first our eyes should be on the prize. First our eyes should be on God. If our eyes are on God, then when these other things come in front of us, if they're inappropriate, we'll be able to push them aside mentally and keep our eyes on God. And so the lust of the eyes can be counteracted by keeping, you know, God as our priority. You shall fear the Eternal your God and serve him, and shall take oaths in his name. Let's go to Deuteronomy 10 and verse 20. Deuteronomy 10 and verse 20. You shall fear the Eternal your God, you shall serve him, and to him you shall hold fast and take oaths in his name. So we commit ourselves to God. Now you don't need to take oaths. If you're going to take an oath, then the oath is going to be to God, but it's not something we have to do. But what we do have to do is serve God and make sure that our commitments are, you know, keeping God in mind above all. You shall fear the Eternal your God, and you shall serve him, and in him you shall hold fast and take oaths in his name. So, the pride of life can be overcome when we realize not to tempt God. You know, you are not the center of the universe. You are not the be all and the end all and the end all. Number one, you know, you, in one sense, you're number one. Obviously, you have to be concerned with yourself. It says love your neighbor as yourself. So you have to love yourself. But don't love yourself so much that you begin to get so proud that, you know, you begin to crowd God out. Don't tempt the Eternal your God. So when you have that tendency to be, you know, overly concerned with self and thinking of yourself as something special, remember the Bible says, don't tempt the Eternal your God. And when you're concerned with what you see and just letting that distract you, remember to keep your eyes on God. And when you lust after something, remember that this world is not just the physical, but the spiritual. So those are three very important lessons that we have to get from the book, that we get from the book of Deuteronomy, which deals with the basic motivations that pull us to sin, which you saw in Genesis, which you saw in 1 John 2. We have to counteract the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. And manna, taught us that lesson, and the waters of Massa, you know, taught us that lesson, and also the entire experience, really, of the children of Israel in the wilderness taught us that lesson, or should have taught us that lesson, should teach us that lesson as we read about it and study about it and think about it and pray about it. So you know where I'm going to now. These very verses gave Jesus Christ the victory at this very climactic time in the history of God's plan, salvation history, this critical moment when Jesus was tested. Let's go to Matthew 4. Jesus had a dual nature, human and divine. Now, one analogy you can use is, let's say you have a piece of metal, a block of metal, and you put it into a fire. The metal is there and it's distinct, but the fire around it eventually heats it up to where it's as hot as the fire. So Jesus had divine nature and human nature, but the divine nature was of such power that he was able to overcome his human nature, and he never sinned. He was both human and divine, so there were two wills and two natures within him, and he always yielded to the will of God. As he said before his arrest, he said, "Not my will, but your will be done," as he prayed. In Matthew 4, he is tested, and I'm going to read about it. I'm going to focus more on the account in Luke, but I want to go here in verse 4. Verse 3, "Now when the tempter came to him, he said, 'If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread,' appealing to the lust of the flesh. But he answered, 'It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God.'" Deuteronomy 8:3. "Then the devil took him up into the holy city, set him on the pinnacle of the temple, and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he shall give his angels charge over you,'" you know, verse 91, Psalm 91, I should say, "and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone." Psalm 91, which is a beautiful, very inspiring psalm that the Jews begin the week with reading, you know, Saturday night, they begin the week with that psalm. Jesus said to him, "It is written again, you shall not tempt the eternal, the Lord your God." Deuteronomy 6 and verse 16. So here he's appealing to the pride of life. If you're the Son of God, you know, he ought to protect you, so you can do this crazy stunt, you know. And then finally, we have the lust of the eyes. So it's not in the same order as in Genesis 3 or in the book of John, because this is probably the chronological order. Matthew is probably writing a history of it and going chronologically. So first he tested him regarding eating, because he fasted 40 days. Then he tested him regarding taking a risk, showing his, you know, that he was God, Son of God. And then thirdly, he tempted him by showing him all these wonderful things he could have if he worshiped the devil. You know, so that's the lust of the eyes. So as I said, it's in chronological order rather than thematic. Is everybody with me? That's what I think is happening here in Matthew's account. And I think it's later on, Luke writes it differently. "Again, the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, 'All these things I will give to you if you will fall down and worship me.'" So remember, Satan is, and as 2 Corinthians 4:4 tells us, Satan is the god of this world. That is to say, he has power and sway. And as much as God allows him, God limits it. But Satan does hold sway over the world. Revelation 12:9, he's deceived all the nations. So no nation is 100% on track. So Satan can give people power as God allows. And verse 10, "Then Jesus said to him, 'Away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve.'" So he's quoting from Deuteronomy 6, 13, and from 10:20. Okay, which I read to you. So he knew his Bible. Well, he gave the Bible, so he ought to know it. But how we need to know our Bible. We need to know our Bible. Now, I want to go to Luke 4, because I believe Luke is handling it thematically. And Luke is going along with Genesis 3 and 1 John 2. Although it was written before 1 John, I believe. So let's go to Luke 4, but it was written after Genesis 3. Let's go to Luke 4. And Jesus, or let's go to verse 7. Oh, let's go further than that. Let's go to the beginning. Luke 4, the beginning. Then Jesus, being filled with the Holy Spirit, returned from the Jordan and was led by the Spirit into the wilderness, being tempted for 40 days by the devil. 40 days, the time of testing. And in those days he ate nothing, and afterward, when they ended, he was hungry. And the devil said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command this stone to become bread," right? The lust of the flesh. But Jesus answered him, saying, "It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word of God." So he knew his Deuteronomy. Then the devil, which of course he gave in the first place. Then the devil, taking him up on a high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. This is the lust of the eyes. And the devil said to him, "All this authority I will give you and their glory, for this has been delivered to me." He wasn't lying. He lies all the time, but in this case he wasn't. "And I give it to you, to whomever I wish." Well, in one sense, of course, God is the ultimate authority, but but Satan can do that as God allows. Verse 7, "Therefore, if you will worship before me, all will be yours." And Jesus answered and said to him, "Get behind me, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." You shall serve. You shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve. And he brought him to Jerusalem, set him on the pinnacle of the temple. So he set him up on a high place where it would be quite a drop down. And said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here." That's the pride of life. The final point there in 1 John 2:15. The final point there in Genesis 3:6, I believe it is, right? Then he brought him to Jerusalem, set him on the pinnacle of the temple, and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here. For it is written, he shall give his angels charge over you to keep you. And in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone." And Jesus answered and said to him, "It has been said, you shall not tempt the Lord your God." Victory! Now when the devil had ended every temptation, he departed from him until an opportune time. Yes, he did have the opportunity to inflict great pain on him, death, suffering, and death. But that was also really a victory. He was resurrected, became, of course, he's our Savior. So Satan's irrational hatred, dishonesty, and violence only in effect leads to his own undoing. And so we have the great victory, which is a victory for all time. Then Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit, verse 14, to Galilee, and news of him went out through all the surrounding region. And today, news of Jesus Christ, the good news, the gospel of the kingdom of God, is going out to all the world, and I have the opportunity to play a part in that, for which I'm very grateful. So let's keep in mind these important principles, you know, that we're led to sin by the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Deuteronomy gives examples of how ancient Israel, well, the Pentateuch gives examples of how ancient Israel was led astray in those ways. They were, of course, admonished by God and through Moses to overcome these things. And those scriptures became a part of the arsenal which Jesus had with him, the sword he had with him to do battle against Satan and to have victory over Satan. Deuteronomy 8:3, Deuteronomy 6:13, Deuteronomy 6:16 and 20 were part of his arsenal, should be part of our spiritual arsenal. So I'm going to take a verse out of context, but it does fit the theme of today's talk. Remember what I talked about today. Lessons 1, 2, 3. Victory with Deuteronomy. I turn now to 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 57. "But thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ." And now the trumpets sound, the chorus rises in a crescendo as we enter the Q&A section. There are several questions that are hanging over, but there's one I wanted to deal with that came from Canada. I actually believe, and eventually I'm going to have to break down and talk about it. It's a controversial subject, but one that I need to cover. But I happen to believe that Queen Elizabeth is a descendant of King David. You don't have to believe that. You can be a very good Christian and not believe that. I don't know whether she believes it. I have read that Queen Victoria did. you've all heard of Queen Victoria. I think you'll read accounts that she did believe herself to be a descendant of David. Whether Elizabeth believes it or not, I do not know. But anyway, she's Queen Elizabeth. Does David have to have a male heir necessarily on the throne? Could he have a female heir on the throne? Well, I believe he can have a female heir on the throne. And I want to go into a prophecy regarding the Davidic covenant. There is a Davidic covenant. God made a covenant with David. You know, David was given an eternal throne. The Messiah was to come from David, the Christ, the Mashiach, Christos in Greek, Mashiach in Hebrew. The King of Kings and Lord of Lords was to come from David. Originally, the promise was to Judah in Genesis 49. And then in 2 Samuel 7 and 23, we see the covenant is made not only with Judah, but now with a specific branch of Judah, the family of David, the Davidic monarchy. So the Messiah is both Davidic and divine. And in Jeremiah 33, there's a prophecy regarding the house of David and regarding the house of Levi. And I want to go to Jeremiah 33. Now, this is at the time of captivity of the Israel or the southern kingdom of Judah. So it's a time when Jeremiah, first of all, let's say, what's the right word, presides over the destruction of his people, but then presides over their restoration, the first steps of it. And then, of course, Ezekiel continues that ministry, and Daniel lives to see the restoration. But we have the destruction and restoration covered in Jeremiah. And in Jeremiah, by the way, this is a side comment, but I talked about archaeology earlier in a more of a lighter vein. But seriously speaking, I may have mentioned this already, but they have uncovered tablets. Did I talk about this last week? They've uncovered tablets. Daniel brought this to my attention, but it's now been covered quite a lot on the news, so maybe some of you have heard about it. They've uncovered tablets that talk about the life of these exiles in Babylonian captivity, and they're now on display in Israel in a museum there. So they actually have found records of the business transactions of these exiles after they were exiled from Babylon, from Judah, into what is today Iraq. So it's interesting, you know, more and more as archaeology develops, more and more biblical material is corroborated, actually. Excuse me, I want to go to Jeremiah 33, and let's go to verse 20. Okay, let's start in verse 19, that here is a prophecy of God to Jeremiah, Yahweh to Jeremiah. And the word of the Eternal came to Jeremiah, saying, this is Jeremiah 33:19. Thus says the Eternal, if you can break my covenant with the day and my covenant with the night, so that there will not be day and night in their season. So this seems to be perhaps a distinct covenant that God made with nature, that, you know, nobody's doubts tomorrow that the sun will rise or that it will set. And this is the way it's going to be until the second coming of Christ. Until the final climax of human history, days and nights will proceed according to scientific laws. At some point, there'll be a disruption at the return of Christ, a brief disruption. Thus says the Eternal. So this seems to be a covenant. So in that sense, I would say it's perhaps in that sense a 13th covenant that I have found. And so we have 12 covenants, which set the stage for that ultimate one, which is the new covenant. So that kind of is above the other 12. So I believe there are 13 altogether. And I know that Wikipedia disagrees with me, but we'll get into that sometime. We'll have a knockdown drag out. Anyway, verse 20. Thus says the Eternal, if you can break my covenant with the day, my covenant with the night, so that there will not be day and night in their season, then my covenant may also be broken with David, my servant. Well, you know, the sun's going to set tonight, the sun's going to rise tomorrow, and the covenant with David is going to be there, and Jesus Christ will return. Excuse me. Then my covenant may also be broken with David, my servant, so that he will not have a son to reign on his throne, and with the Levites, the priests, my ministers. I want to jump down to verse 25. Well, I get, maybe I just should keep reading so that I don't leave anything out. Verse 22. Am I in verse 21? No, I read it. So it's verse 22. As the host of heaven cannot be numbered, nor the sand of the sea measured, so will I multiply the descendants of David, my servant, and the Levites who minister to me. Moreover, the word of the Eternal came to Jeremiah, saying, Have you not considered what these people have spoken, saying, the two families which the Eternal has chosen, he has also cast them off? You know, as you know, the temple was destroyed, the monarchy was imprisoned, the monarchs were imprisoned. The two families which the Eternal has chosen, he has also cast them off. Thus they have despised my people, as if they should no more be a nation before them. Thus says the Eternal, verse 25, if my covenant is not with day and night, and if I have not appointed the ordinances of heaven and earth, then I will cast away the descendants of Jacob and David, my servant, so that I will not take any of his descendants to be rulers over the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. For I will cause their captives to return, and I will have mercy on them. There is one more verse that I wanted to read. Maybe the way it's translated here has thrown me off. But anyway, let's go back. I'll go back to a Hebrew English version. The question is, can there be a female heir to the throne and the prophecy be fulfilled? Does it have to be a male? Well, my answer to that is that it does not have to necessarily be a male. However, even if you insisted that it has to be a male, it could work out. Let me just read what's going on here in the Hebrew. It had to do with the word man. There's one translation that talks about no son. He will never lack a son to rule. And then in another place it says he will never lack a man to rule. But I think they're already anticipating what I'm saying, and they're just translating it as a descendant, that he shall never lack a descendant to rule. I'm going to verse 21 here. No, here it says a son, but it's interesting. Here it's translated a descendant. So they're already anticipating what I'm saying. But I'm looking for the word man, that it says that he'll never lack a man to rule over Israel. It's in that section there in Jeremiah 33. He shall never lack a man. Okay, here it is. All right, I'm in verse 17. Maybe I read over it, but here in the Hebrew, here's how it's translated in the Jewish translation, verse 17. In those days Judah shall be delivered and Israel shall be secure, and this is what they shall be called, what she shall be called. The Eternal is our vindication. Or Yahweh Tzidkenu, the Eternal is our righteousness. But it's a good translation, the Eternal is our vindication. For thus says the Eternal, there shall never be an end to men of David's line who sit upon the throne of the house of Israel. That's verse 17. Well, what did my New King James say? My New King James said in verse 17, David shall never lack a man. So for some reason I didn't read it before. Let me go back to it. For thus says the Eternal, I'm back in the New King James now. David shall never lack a man to sit on the throne of the house of Israel, nor shall the priests, the Levites, lack a man. Verse 18, to offer burnt offerings before me, to kindle grain offerings, and to sacrifice continually. That prophecy is being fulfilled before your eyes. There's a priest talking to you now. There's a priest running the graphics. But the throne of David also exists. The family of David is around. And as I said, I believe it can be found in the royal family of England. But that, you know, that's not, you don't have to believe that. But the family of David is preserved and theoretically could provide a ruler for Israel, you know, at least theoretically. And what I'm saying is that the word son that you saw, that you see later, that he shall not lack a son, verse 21, that could be translated loosely as descendant, as it is in the Jewish translation. Because if you go back to the word ish, it says that he shall not lack a man, verse 17, ish, to rule. Verse 17, that word ish, let's go back, let's go up to the screen. I think the word ben is on the screen for son, and the word ish is on the screen for man. The word ben means son. Some of you know that ben in Hebrew means son. And then the word ish means man. Well, as I said, son here could be loosely translated descendant, because Ish could also be translated loosely, a person. We say that in English often, or we used to more so before we became very sensitive about it. But we also often talked about, you know, no man has done this, meaning no human being has done this. And the use of the word Ish in some ways is like the English word each, you know, Ish and each. And let me show you some examples of that. I want to go to Genesis 15:11. And here it says, let's go to verse 10, 15:10. Then he brought all these to him and cut them in two. I mean, I'm talking about these are sacrifices that Abraham is offering. Genesis 15:10. Then he brought all these to him and cut them in two down the middle and placed each piece opposite the other. Here we're talking about pieces of animals, and in the Hebrew the word ish is used. If you look at the Hebrew text of Genesis 15:10, the word ish is there. Each one, each piece opposite the other. But he did not cut the birds in two. So here we're talking about pieces and each one, and it's, and the word ish is used. Now let's go to Isaiah 40. Isaiah 40 and verse 26. And here we're talking about stars and heavenly bodies, and the word ish is used there. Isaiah 40 and verse 26. Lift up your eyes on high and see who created these things, who brings out their host by number, who calls them all by name, by the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, not one is missing. And the word one here is ish in Hebrew. So not one of these heavenly bodies is missing, and the word ish is used for. There may be a poetic use, but it is interesting. And then if I want to go to Job 42 and verse 11, Job 42 and verse 11, then all his brothers, this is the positive side, this is the end of the story of Job, which is positive. Job 42:11. Then all his brothers, all his sisters, and all those who had been his acquaintances before came to him and ate food with him in his house. And they consoled him and comforted him for all the adversity that the Eternal had brought upon him. Each one gave him a piece of silver, and each a ring of gold. Each one. And, you know, it's the word I think there is also ish, each one, even though they're talking about brothers and sisters. Okay? So, again, you see, Tanakh version of that and see how they translate it in Job 42:11. So I'm going to go now to Job 42:11 in the Tanakh version. All his brothers and sisters and his former friends came to him and had a meal with him in his house. They consoled and comforted him for all the misfortune that had brought upon him. Each gave him one casita and each one gold ring. So they don't translate casita, whereas the other did. And it says here, ish. The word is ish, and they translated each. You know, so ish becomes each. Are you with me? Okay, so you haven't lost me. Okay, so all I'm saying is that when we say he won't lack a man or he won't lack a son, it could be in the sense of a person, a descendant. Because it doesn't say he will not lack a male. It doesn't have the Hebrew word zachar, meaning a male. It says he won't lack a son, he won't lack a man, or as I said, it could refer to a descendant or a person. And I think, and we see that all through the Bible. I want to go to Revelation 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 18, where it's more specific. And sometimes we do get more specific. Sometimes we are careful to say men and women. You know, sometimes we are careful about that. And in 2 Corinthians 6:18, Paul is careful about that. 2 Corinthians 6:18, I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. So there he's very specific, sons and daughters. But now go to the end of the Bible, Revelation 21 and verse 6. And here it's used in a more generic sense. Revelation 21 and verse 7, I'm sorry, 21:7. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. Well, obviously, he's talking about people. Salvation, obviously, is for men and women. I just read it to you. So here it's being used in the generic sense. So I think the point is that David will not lack a descendant, and it could be Queen Victoria or Queen Elizabeth. However, Let's say that you want to be really picky about it and demand that it be a male. It's still possible for the prophecy to be fulfilled if the family is intact. It really just means the royal family must remain intact. Because if the royal family remains intact, there's going to be a male who theoretically could rule, depending on the rules of succession that people establish. Let me go back to Deuteronomy 28. And I'm sorry, Numbers 28, and you'll see what I mean. Once again, we go back to our famous daughters of Zelophehad. I often talk about those ladies. I'm sorry, Numbers 27. Numbers 27, the daughters of Zelophehad. And notice what it says here about inheritance. All right? I hope you haven't lost me. This is really a very simple question and answer. I'm just really digging into it. But it's really a very simple question and answer. But I told the person who asked me from Canada, I said, I'm going to prove it to you. So I decided I was going to take the time and really dig in, you know, so that, you know, there was no doubt. So Numbers 27 and verse 8. And you shall speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall cause his inheritance to pass to his daughter. If he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And if his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to the relative closest to him in his family, and he shall possess it. So if the family is intact at all, there's going to be some male relative. You know, you keep going till you find some male relative, you know, to do it. And it shall be to the children of Israel a statute of judgment, just as the Eternal commanded Moses. So I would say it's the same thing in a royal line of succession. You just keep going. You keep going until you find a male relative, if you insist that it has to be a male, which you know, it doesn't. It depends on the rules of succession that are in place in that kingdom. In many kingdoms, if there's no male heir, the daughter becomes queen. In some others, there may be other ways it's handled. But the point of the prophecy is that the royal family would be there and would therefore be potentially able to provide a male to rule. And I believe that prophecy prophecy has been fulfilled. We could just argue how, but the prophecy has been fulfilled. And whether it's fulfilled in the royal family of the UK, as I said, I believe that you don't have to. But the prophecy has been fulfilled. The family of David exists, and theoretically there could be a ruler of that family ruling at the present time. Priests and Levites we know exist, and as I said, there's one talking to you now. So that prophecy has obviously been fulfilled. Now, ultimately, the prophecy will be fulfilled with the second coming of Christ, a descendant of David, and he will resurrect King David, his ancestor, to rule under him. And we can really look forward to that time. So I hope that answers the question adequately about the prophecy to the family of David about having an heir. I want to mention a couple of important announcements. As I said early in this talk, I was looking to make sure I had this announcement. One of my friends over the years has been Phil Rice, Philip Rice. Many of you knew his father, Richard Rice. He also was a friend. But Richard Rice has died, but his son Philip is alive, but his son Philip's wife has died. Lil Rice, the wife of Philip Rice, died following a lengthy illness. Philip is in Baton Rouge with his mother, and he has his own health problems and is on disability. So please keep in mind Phil and his mother, and pray about them and comfort for them and strength for them. I also want to update you regarding, excuse me just a moment, I have a cold. Not a major issue. Okay. I would like to ask you a continued prayers. By the way, I have some good announcements to make. I think all of you realize my neighbor, Gary, who was ill, is back home and doing well. So thank you for your prayers on his behalf. I've also heard that Ron Dart, who many of you were praying for, is doing a lot better. So we certainly thank you for your prayers on behalf of those people. And we need your continued prayers for Lauren Davies. We need your continued prayers for him. His wife, June, has been in touch with us, and also a minister in Canada has been in touch with us about it, Dave Campbell. But June has informed us that Lauren was tested, as some of you knew he would be tested, and we were We were fearful the test could affect his kidneys, which were weak. And it turned out the test seemingly did not adversely affect his kidneys. So he had gone through that and seemed to be in a position where possibly he could return home from the hospital. He wouldn't be in the, you know, in the best of shape, but at least he could be at home and with God's help could live on for, you know, however long God allows. He does have certain problems that they cannot operate on with his heart, but there are certain things they can do to alleviate some of the problem and allow him to go home and live a relatively normal life. However, he had pain today in parts of his body that would indicate that perhaps the kidneys were affected by the test. So let's all pray that that God would intervene and he wouldn't have an issue with his kidneys, and that then they could go ahead and do whatever else they need to do to help him, where he could then be able to return home and relatively, you know, in a relatively, well, a much better position, and be able to function at home with his wife and continue to be the very positive influence that he has been for many, many years. So let's continue to pray for Lauren Davies and his family, Lauren June, and the community up there that he serves, you know, the Canadian Brethren up there. So we thank you again for your interest in the ministry, and we thank you for these questions that are coming in. And I only dealt with one today. I wanted to deal with it thoroughly, but I'll try to deal with whatever questions are coming in. For those of you who are having a three-day weekend here in the United States, we pray for your safety. And for all of you around the world, wherever you are, all the best to you and yours.